I'm sitting in front of my 90-key keyboard, and every time I strike a key, one of the little brass moles will be released and ends up in a little place in front of me where a whole row of them will be, a whole line of type. So if I set my name, R-A-Y-M-O-N-D, Raymond, and is a nice young man. That's not much truth to that. I'm nice, but I'm not young. I'll be 85 soon, so I'm getting there.
The Linotype machine looks like you'd imagine a brilliant invention is supposed to look. Sort of like if a typewriter and a train engine got together and had a baby. Spinning cogs, whirring gear belts, and clacking keys. It's a Rube Goldberg contraption the size of a refrigerator, and a lot louder. Here's how it works.
Has a keyboard on it. It has a strange keyboard if you're used to keyboards. Our keyboard has 90 keys on it.
No shift key.
If you want capitals, you go to the right side of the keyboard. On the white keys are the capitals. And on the other side, the black keys are the lowercase letters on the left side.
In the middle are the blue keys, punctuation marks.
And every time you hit a key, one of the little brass molds comes out of a container that we call a magazine.
These little brass molds each have an alphabet letter on them. There are about 1,400 of these little pieces loaded in an overhead metal cartridge.
So every time you hit one of these strange keys on the keyboard, one of the molds is released from the magazine, and pretty soon you have a row or a line of them.
That's why the machine is called a Linotype, by the way. And once you have your row of letters lined up, you pull a lever, and they shuttle over to
the casting part that has a place where we have hot liquid metal, type metal being heated up to its liquid.
A 500-degree molten alloy of lead, tin, and antimony.
And we actually pump hot liquid metal into those molds or shapes or matrix, whatever you want to call them.
So out pops a cooled metal line of type. It looks like a little silver miniature Hershey's bar with a sentence engraved on the side. Then all those tiny individual brass letters that spelled out that sentence take a ride back to their hopper in a little elevator.
The elevator is coming down, switches them off, carries them all back to the top, and slowly they'll be sorted out and put back exactly where they started.
Just like an automatic coin sorter with 90 different coins to sort. Mr. Loomis says it's graceful, but it's as tough as it is delicate.
And it has to be as old as it is. It's 78 years old, and it still does exactly the way it was supposed to do the first day it was made. It does the same exact thing.
That thing revolutionized the print industry. Thomas Edison called the Linotype machine the eighth wonder of the world. It was the biggest thing to come along since the Gutenberg press.
Somewhere in the 1450s, a fellow named Gutenberg invented the idea of making movable type. He made lots of A's and B's and C's, and then put them into little wooden boxes, a case we call it. And the compositor, the typesetter, would stand in front of the case and pick out each letter, one letter at a time. And that lasted from 1450 to 1886. Not much changed in that time. And in 1886, downtown Baltimore, where we are here, another German fellow, his name was Mergenthaler, Otmar Mergenthaler, came to America as a young person. Wasn't even 18 when he got here. And he was already journeyman watchmaker. Watchmaker doesn't know much about printing, but he did know how to make precision-made machines, and that's what this machine is.
With Mergenthaler's invention, the typesetting industry got 6 times faster, instantly. The clatter of Linotype machines rang out on newspaper production lines for the next 80 years. Each page of each issue was printed off a metal plate, forged one line at a time. And poetically, those metal plates were melted back down after each issue. The molten alloy would be cast again to make the next day's news.
Problem with the spaces. When you're setting type in a newspaper, you're not allowed to do any of this fixing business. Here I have to do it. I don't have nobody to call to come and fix it. But in the newspaper, you have a button on your side of your machine. And when you have a problem like this, you just push the button. And the machinist, he sees your light lit, and he comes over and he says, let me take care of that for you. And he'll do all the fixing that needs to be done to get it fixed. I'm having a hard time getting this one out there.
During his 70-year career, Mr. Loomis worked as a Linotype operator at the News American, the Baltimore Sun, and the Washington Post. Today, he still wears a printer's apron stained with ink and soot. He raises his eyebrows, purses his lips, runs a hand through his hair, and squints down at the keyboard in front of him, tapping away just as he has since he was young. Only now, he's doing it at a museum. Mr. Loomis spends his Saturday afternoons in the historical print shop at the Baltimore Museum of Industry. Visitors come by and marvel at his mastery over this odd, outdated curio. There are only a few left that are still in running condition, but back in the 1940s, thousands of these things rattled away in print shops across the country. That was the Linotype heyday, and coincidentally, right around that time, a young Raymond Loomis was looking around at the world and grasping something important.
I started to realize that without money, you couldn't do much. And I would run errands and, you know, get a penny here and a nickel there. And I thought, well, how can you get some real money? And I figured you have to have a job.
One problem, though, for the entrepreneurial 13-year-old, child labor law.
The cutoff date that I found was 15 years old. If you were 15, you could get a permit from the city hall. Your mom would sign a paper, and they'd give you a permit so that you could work.
He wasn't old enough to work yet, but that didn't stop him from lining up a job for himself in a print shop.
Around a corner from where we lived, about a block one way and a block the other way, I got my mother to take me down City Hall. She signed a paper. Now I can work. I've got a job. So I went in there, and the first thing I did was run errands, sweep the floor.
And where was this exactly, your first job?
West Baltimore on Monroe and Frederick Avenue, a place called Oliver Press.
At 15 years old, though, Loomis was still too young to be allowed to touch the printing presses where he worked.
So I would stand there and watch the machine, and when something go wrong, I would holler, hey, you know, and the regular guy would come over and he would fix it. And I just keep an eye on it, that kind of stuff. And then eventually I got to the point where I was old enough, then they'd start letting me touch things and a little bit more all the time.
He was getting paid too, 40 cents an hour.
And I remember the first time I worked a full week, 40 times 40 was $16. And you didn't get any checks or anything. You get the cash money, and it was stuffed in a little brown envelope. And I can see that in my mind's eye, that little brown envelope with the money stuffed in there. Now, for somebody, a quarter was rich. $16 was really rich. So I went home, took a $10 bill out. We were poor, you know, we were struggling along. I take that $10 bill out and I hand it to my mother, and I felt like a big shot. I mean, here I'm giving my mother $10. And she loved that, you know. But I didn't give her much after that. I start saving up for buy an automobile. And by the time I was 19, I had saved enough money to buy a brand new car cash.
And what was it?
It was a 1949 Nash 600, robin's egg blue color. And it was a car that you could make. This was one of the features when you bought the car. It was for sportsmen. You could take it out when you're trip out in the field somewhere, and you could take the back seat and fold it down and make a bed out of the whole car. And they sold a little special mattress that rolled up and put in there. So that was one of the selling features of that car. Nash 600. I kept it 11 months and traded it in and got a 1950. I wanted a bigger engine, so I had to get the Ambassador, 1950 Nash Ambassador. It looks just like the other car, only just a little bigger here and there. It was much more powerful, and of course, every young man wants the biggest engine he can get for some reason.
When he was saving up the money to buy that first car, Loomis was going to Ottmar Mergenthaler Vocational High School of Printing, a school named in honor of the man who invented the linotype machine.
It was located at Green Mountain Eager Street, right in back of the penitentiary. It was an old, old building. And the whole school was like 90 students and probably about six or seven teachers. And that's all they taught there was printing. And I went in. I was pretty much a dummy academically. I didn't pay much attention. The teacher told my mother I was dilatory. I'm still not sure what that means, but she said I would sit there and on my desk and look out the window, and I'd be imagining what I was going to do when I got home, I guess, you know, and never paid any attention, never did the homework, just skimmed by, just made it. Every time it came passing time, I was sweated it out, but I made it.
By the time he graduated, though, Loomis had risen to the top of his class. His teachers awarded him a gold medal for his success.
So it was quite a shock when I did all that, because I wasn't striving to win anything. I was just doing I just loved what I was doing.
At this point, he was working after school at another print shop.
I remember I got a big raise when I showed him my gold medal. He says, man, I'm going to have to give you a raise. So I got a dollar an hour raise, which was a lot of money. And then then I start falling in love with the young lady, and next thing you know, I'm getting married. I've been married to the same lady almost 64 years, and she hasn't been blessed with the same good health I have. I've been blessed with good health, never had any serious illnesses, and I don't sit around moping and doing nothing. In fact, I was working up to 2 months ago. I had a part-time job that I would go to work whenever they called, doing odds and ends in the print shop. And they sold the place, and they moved the whole place. And I was offered to go along, and I told them, nothing doing. I'm almost 85, and I'm going to retire for good. So that's what I've been retired for good for 2 months now. And I don't particularly like it, but who cares? I've been working since I was 15, and work is just part of me.
Now that he's retired, Mr. Loomis has a quiet routine. He says he gets up every morning and reads the news on the computer. But he comes in to volunteer at the Baltimore Museum of Industry every Saturday, where he pulls up a chair to the old contraption that he spent so much of his life with. It was a revolutionary invention. Now, it's an artifact.
As progress went on, all of a sudden, one day they woke up and these machines were obsolete because something better came along. And something better was the computer that became our typesetter. Once they figured out how to make all that work, they even swiped all our typefaces, like Times Roman. If you have a computer, you have Times Roman on there. Started right here on a Linotype machine that was made specially for this typesetting machine.
It's hard to argue against the superiority of the computer. It's pretty much better than the Linotype machine in just about every possible way. Except one. It doesn't sound nearly as beautiful. You can see photos of Ray Loomis at his Linotype machine on our website, wypr.org/programs/signal. For The Signal, I'm Aaron Henkin.
From WIPR in Baltimore, this is The Signal. I'm Andy Bienstock. Zero Gravity Creations is the name of a glass and metal sculpture studio in Baltimore. It's also become the incubator of a new patent-pending invention called Magma Bond. The technology is a blessing to metal and glass artists, but it may well revolutionize the way things get made in the rest of the world, too. Aaron Henkin brings us the story.
So this is what 2,300 degrees sounds like. Oh, I think I've lit the end of the microphone on fire.
Like the open mouth of a fire-breathing dragon, a raging orange glow radiates out of a furnace at Zero Gravity Creations headquarters, a garage-turned-hot-glass shop in southeast Baltimore. Tim McFadden stares into the glow. He's got one end of a long metal pipe in there, and he's twirling it around in a pool of molten glass. He pulls the pipe out, still twirling it, while a baseball-sized blob of glass, the consistency of caramel, warps and bobbles on the end. He pours a ladle full of water on the pipe.
So what I'm doing now is I'm cooling the handle off so that it keeps the rod nice and safe for my fingers so the heat doesn't creep up the stainless steel to where your hands are.
McFadden is creating a decorative centerpiece for a client's dining room table. It's going to take about 2 hours, two straight hours.
Once you start it, it's like a piece of music. You start it and you have to finish it all in one consecutive swoop.
And so much of what he's doing is so subtle.
Eric Wanveer is McFadden's co-founder here at Zero Gravity Creations.
So he makes it look so easy. It's like skateboarding or something. You know, you see the guy and it looks so easy until you stand on a skateboard yourself, until you hold the pipe and what he's doing now looks so simple and your glass falls onto the floor.
Wanveer is actually not a glass blower himself. He's a metal worker, a sculptor. Together, he and his partner create art pieces, elegant hybrids of metal and glass. Along the way, though, Wanveer has become, much to his own surprise, the inventor of something potentially really, really valuable. A way to chemically fuse a piece of glass to a piece of metal.
This is one of our early experiments. It's clear. You can see this bond here that you see happens all hot when this is 2,000 degrees.
In the office next to the hot glass shop, Wanveer shows off what he's dubbed Magma Bond. Lo and behold, it's a decorative glass bulb bonded to to a metal base. Wanvier invented this technology as a way to help artisans like himself make more graceful chandeliers and fixtures. Usually, glassblowers end up having to use something like chicken wire to hold their creations together.
And I thought, you know, why not make beautiful the joint that connects the glass to this metal structure that's actually supporting it?
So he went into the hot glass shop one day with a hunch about how to do this. And to his surprise,
it worked. In all cases, it took me hitting them with a hammer to remove the glass from the metal. They're bonded at the molecular level.
Wanvier thought, that's pretty cool. But he didn't know quite how cool until he put together a gallery exhibition of glass pieces that showcased this new magma bond method. Fellow glass artists came to the exhibition and their jaws dropped.
They either wanted to buy it, you know, they would give us money to teach them how to do it and to buy our blowpipes from us. And the others that didn't do that were taking pictures of our work and came over and you know, like going to see another artist like five times in the same show, is it just doesn't happen usually.
So the day after the show closed, Wanvier introduced himself to a team of patent attorneys. They were as impressed with Magma Bond as the artists from the show.
So they went and they looked up anything that had to do with anything about glass blowing and came back with this awesome report of every patent that's happened since the U.S. Patent Office opened, and I got an awesome history in U.S. glass blowing apparatuses and patents.
At this point, the lawyers told Wanvier, look, you've invented a technology that's actually way more useful than just making nice-looking chandeliers. What you need to do now is brainstorm every possible application for your invention.
Once you start to think about it, you realize how often metal and glass come together, from cars to laboratories to operating rooms. I mean, it's amazing when you think about it.
So Wanvier drew a big chart with Magma Bond right in the middle. He started drawing lines out in every direction to all the different market sectors where it could be used, and then from each sector out to all the different products it could be used in. He's actually been at this process for a couple of years now, and he's come up with 40 different applications for Magma Bond, and the list keeps growing.
We're just starting to explore scuba uses, marine uses, naval uses, underwater diving uses. I found out that glass spheres are often used for marine buoyancy on submarines and various things because glass is one of the strongest, hardest materials. So if you make glass spheres because of the geometric shape, it actually withstands one of the strongest materials to withstanding deep pressure. So we could make underwater lighting like the world's never seen.
And that is how an inventor is born. Coming up with a clever invention is just the first part. Figuring out what to do with it takes just as much creativity. That part, by the way, could also make you very rich.
We're not just trying to be the only people who do it. Ultimately, once we get our patents locked down, you know, we want to be able to license this so that the manufacturing world at large, the glassblowers at large, can do this, that this will be a method that's taught in glassblowing in art schools, that this will be a method that Corning and GE use to produce light bulbs all over the world.
Magma Bond is, as they say, patent pending. The process is long and expensive, but for Wanvier, it's become his life's work.
I mean, this is like my dream.
Other kids might have grown up admiring movie stars or athletes. For Wanvier, his heroes were inventors.
I mean, I went to Monticello as a young age, and I was in awe. You know, what that guy was able to do as an architect and a furniture designer, clocks, you know, built his own clocks, built the elevators, patented his own farming plow. To be a true Renaissance man in that sense, that's what I admired about those guys. And then, you know, Ben Franklin, from the glass harmonica to the lightning rod, you know, that's what I wanted to be. And it wasn't so much that I wanted to be an inventor as that I wanted to find an original idea that was mine and that I could contribute to humanity. And it's not as cool as the lightning rod, maybe. It's not going to save as many lives. But I'm pretty proud of it, and it's mine. And granted, too, this is my first thing. So what I'll be into 10 years from now, I can't say.
Co-founder of Zero Gravity Creations and inventor of Magma Bond, Eric Wanvier. You can find him online at zerogravitycreations.com. For The Signal, I'm Aaron Hinken.